Welcome to the Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zero. With me, as always, is professional film critic Sean Patrick. Visit us at IHateCritics.net, Everyone's a Critic Podcast.com, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Our handle is Critics Pod. We're on all the podcatchers, Alexa, Spotify, Google, Apple, something over in India. We're all over the place. So subscribe to us wherever you listen to us so that you don't miss an episode. Write and review the show. We'll read your reviews on the air. If you want to email us, critics@ihatecritics.net. Best way to get in touch with us outside of our social media. And Patreon, patreon.com/criticspods. The best way to help support the podcast. We also have our TeePublic page over at ihatecritics.net. Click on the little icon up in the right-hand corner to buy yourself some merch. Okay, we have a lot of movies. Sounds like at least one you like, so we can jump right into it.
I just want to do a little tease coming up soon. There's a Netflix movie, one of their big ones, coming up very soon that I've seen, and I can't say what it is yet, but I hate it. I hate it so much, and I wrote 4,000 words about how much I hate it.
Can you release it yet, or have you have to hold
not
on to till,
that too? October 16th is the day everybody's going to have to wait to see how much I hate this movie. But it's one of the higher profile ones, and I was really shocked at how bad it is.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, based on our text thread going back and forth, I feel like we're going to be arguing over what's the worst movie this week. and like, that's going to be as heated as it gets, and I just have to remind myself, I don't like either one of these, so why am I so passionate? Anyway, let's just go to the one that I found to be the ones I watched, the one I hated the least. And we'll start with Hubie Halloween.
Hubie Halloween, starring Adam Sandler and directed by Stephen Brill, you know, that legend of cinema, Stephen Brill. The story goes that Hubie is this weirdo, because he's Adam Sandler, who is devoted to Halloween in Salem, known for the witch trials. They celebrate Halloween in a big way there, and Hubie's made himself a part of Halloween by trying to keep everybody safe, by being essentially the Halloween monitor or whatever nonsense thing he's made up. This isn't a movie. This is a series of running gags that, you know, either you find these running gags funny or you don't. And I didn't. Never got funny. There's this thing where he rides his bike around town, and every time he rides his bike around town, people are throwing things at him, and he's able to just dodge out of the way. And I kept waiting for it to get funny. I kept waiting for it to get funny. It never got funny. There's a running gag with Steve Buscemi, who I guess is pretending to be a werewolf for whatever reason, but he's always just Steve Buscemi. Kept waiting. Just kept waiting. See, this is, maybe it'll be funny. Nope. Just kind of happens. And that's really just the kind of the tone and the what happens with Hubie Halloween. Now, I will say this. Of all of Sandler's movies, this is the most forgettably terrible. it's inoffensively terrible. Like, I wasn't actively angry at this movie the way I have been in the past at Sandler movies, so there's that. It's less racist than his usual work, so that's another plus. Beyond that, I think that's all the praise I have for this movie, is that it's not hateful and it goes by fast enough.
And I guess here's, and maybe the bar is low, obviously, and I'm watching it, and there's two lenses you watch this. You watch it straight ahead like a Sandler fan would, mm-hmm. and neither one of us can really be that person. So part of me is watching it as if I'm watching Sean watch it. So that alone is somewhat, like, there's an entertainment there that it's not really, the movie shouldn't get credit for that. So, but there's still, and then the fact that it's not hateful, like, it sets itself up to be. And yeah. I was kind of happy that it, all of a sudden, you know, he really wasn't an idiot, even though he was an idiot. And, you know, he ends up, no matter how poorly he's treated, I mean, it's a lame, lame message that you see in any other, you know, movie with heart. but it got there, and I was like, okay, cool. I'm okay with the way that, basically, I'm okay with the way they got there, and it worked. Whatever. I'm never going to watch it again. I definitely, like, I was all ready to make a boner joke, or that was going to be the title of the podcast, but I was already, that by the time that got, that was funny for like half a second to me, only because of, I don't know. It really wasn't even that funny. It was more of the fact that it was Sean had to watch it that made it funny.
The only person who needs any credit on this is whoever went t-shirt shopping for June Squibb.
Yes.
That person is the only person who gets any credit whatsoever. I didn't laugh at any of that because, you know, old people, you know, misunderstanding t-shirts or dirty phrases is just, you know, pretty much a staple of Sandler's humor as well. But at the very least, I was impressed that somebody either came up with and made those or found them somewhere. They looked like they could have been found, which if you found those, I would be very impressed. That would make me very happy. I would laugh at that if you were able to find those shirts. You made them. All right. Yeah, I get it. That's good.
Yeah. I mean, now that we've talked about it, though, I feel like whenever you go online, now you're going to get ads for those shirts. Because they exist. Yeah, I mean, it's...
There's one element of this that bordered on pissing me off a little bit, and that is there's this element at the end where it becomes about kind of meta, about Sandler, about I'm just trying to make people happy, and you guys are just being mean, stupid critics. And no, that's not what this is about.
Yeah, I was too far away to pick up on that part. I mean, I see it now that you say it.
Yeah,
there was a part of me that was watching it like, is he making fun of all of his movies? Because what I found funny was almost how stupid it was. Not the gags themselves, but how bad they were that it almost kind of made me laugh. And it's hard to know if that was intentional or not, because, again, we're watching it through different lenses than the audience is intended for.
Right.
So, I mean, I brought a lot to this to make it entertaining enough. But I mean, it's a forgettable Sandler movie. I mean, and I don't think you've seen a lot of his Netflix stuff, but they're all kind of in this vein. I feel like it's better than the ones that he's doing up until the end there that were going to the theater. But I mean, this is more along the lines of like the Big Daddy era, only maybe even less memorable than that.
Well, I mean, his stuff when the end of his theatrical run was utterly fucking miserable. Yeah. I mean, it really was with Daddy's Boy or whatever that was.
The grown-up movies are bad. Yeah,
And Just Go With It. All that, the vacation movies that he was making. Just grown-ups. Just all that was just. It was to a point where it was utterly hateful on his part that he kept subjecting people to these. Yeah. This is not that. This isn't outright disrespectful of the audience.
Yeah, like what I thought was really bad about those movies you just mentioned is clearly they were having fun. They were all on vacation. They're all friends. But you did not get that sense at all in those movies. At least here you could kind of tell some of them were having fun. You're not necessarily having fun with them, but you can, you at least can tell there. He was able to translate that a little better here. But again, not to the extent of like something Seth Rogen has done or whatever. You know, but I mean, it is what it is. We've already spent way too much time on Hubie Halloween, but
yeah, I feel like though when Seth Rogen and his friends get together, there's an actual intent and a purpose, and they have a point, and they actually have a good idea.
Well, right, but I mean, still, when you capture that, but there's still you can capture that energy from the set that you get carries through. Kevin Smith does it a lot too, where that energy comes through to the movie itself, and you're feeling it with them. And there's definitely has to be an energy here because everybody's in the same. I mean, the Adam Sandler crew is they've done all the movies together. They keep adding more people to it. Shaq's back, Dan Patrick. And it just, you know, they're having a blast because they all keep coming back. But you just don't feel that energy. Maybe you're right. Maybe it's because there's no it's such a lame setup and, you know, juvenile that that's why it's not translating through. But either way, you're not feeling that energy. Here you felt it a little more than you have in the past. But again, you're still not feeling it like some of the artists we mentioned earlier. Okay, we can move on. my opinion. Or go ahead. You're going to say something?
I just say, should we get to the truly funny movie this week?
The Lie?
Exactly.
Okay, that's where I was going anyway.
This is the funniest movie of the year. No, it's funny. No, it's not supposed to be. The Lie stars Peter Sarsgaard, Muriel Enos, and Joey King. As a former family, they're a divorced family now. Mom is handing off the daughter to dad. He's taking her to a ballet weekend. They stop to pick up her friend. She and the friend have a fight. They get out of the car. They run off into the snow. The friend ends up being killed by the little girl, Joy King. And the parents decide that they're going to have to cover this up to try and keep their daughter out of jail. And the utter misguidedness of this plot, it comes through just almost immediately. Like, it takes them deciding for just a moment that they're not going to call the cops at the scene pretty much ends the movie. That's the decision that ends the movie. Now, it doesn't have to. Like, a better movie could perhaps build something creepy or you know, exciting or different about like a Coen brothers probably could take a premise like that and do something with it. But this movie wants you to feel sympathy for these parents of this, essentially this psychotic little girl who feels absolutely nothing about murdering her friend, and they're covering it up. And it's a failure of tone there, but it gets worse. They find a way to make this worse going on throughout. They keep piling on elements that somehow take a bad idea and turn it into an even worse idea, to a point when they arrive at a twist that is so laughable that it is the biggest laugh I've had in a movie all year. And I've seen some good comedy this year, but I've not laughed at anything as hard as the final minute here, where Peter Sarsgaard and Muriel Enos turn to look at a character who's walked into the room. I laughed so hard at that. And you're not supposed to.
You felt it coming, didn't you?
Oh, I did. I did. I just wasn't sure just how stupid it was going to be, though.
To me, if you leave that twist in, then you got to call the cops at the scene. You know what I'm saying? That's yeah. The only way to make it work, because then you can at least get the paranoia going. You can get the dynamic between the former spouses and the kid, and at least you could start something there. But no, you're right. From Jump Street, they ruined the tone of this, and you just don't care. You can't. Mm-hmm. Like, there's movies where, like, you go, I would never do that. And then there's movies where nobody would ever do that. And this is a nobody would ever do it type of a scenario. Mm. And it just, from there, it just keeps going to the next person where they would never do that. Nobody would ever, you know, it just kept snowballing from there. And to the point where I got boring. I mean, I guess I didn't laugh as much because I was more annoyed. But yeah. I get why you would. Plus, go ahead.
I just felt so bad for Peter Sarsgaard and Muriel Enos, who are good actors, and you can see that they're giving all of themselves to this. And there's this poignant quality to seeing people dedicate so much talent to something so very, very stupid. Mm-hmm. And something that is just clearly not working. And we know it's not working, and they don't really know it. And there's just this pathetic quality to this movie that I'm just like, oh, Peter, no. Mm-hmm. And you're good. You're better. Oh, don't do that. Don't. Oh, no. I just felt so sorry for them putting in such amazing effort. You can see just how hard they're working, especially at the end.
Yeah.
And it's all for nothing.
Yeah, they definitely aren't the problem. And I mean, I could see why you would think this is, we need to talk about Kevin or something like that when you're reading the script, or at least the premise. I mean,
right.
You know, maybe the script goes into a little more about the decision to leave the scene, or maybe they don't even leave the scene. I don't know. But it's so, they just kind of move on so quickly that you never for a second even consider that option. And mm-hmm. you're just annoyed from the get-go. And it never comes back. I don't even know how it could. You know, the mom is equally as bad.
Yeah, she starts destroying evidence the second she gets a chance.
Yeah, I mean, it's... yeah, it just didn't pace itself.
There's no moral questioning. Like, she is just like, it's my daughter. I gotta keep her out of jail. Okay.
Yeah.
If that's... If that, That's your instinct. That's your immediate instinct. Your child has committed cold-blooded murder, and your instinct immediately, without thought, is to cover that up. You're the problem.
Right. And, I mean, even if that's your instinct, but you don't act on it. I mean, I could see that being the instinct, but there should at least be...
I understand having a conversation about
right.
it. Right. I understand the conversation.
Yes.
I don't understand how, but then when it goes to actually executing the wrong idea.
The fact of the matter is there's no conversation, and that's where all the tension's at, is in the conversation. And they just glance past that. You know, make that your movie. It really isn't that hard. But they don't. They leave all the tension off to the side and make either, depending on the frame of mind you're in when you're watching it, either a boring or hilarious movie.
Oh, man. That twist is hilarious.
Yeah, because
it's so stupid. It's so dumb.
Largely because they paint themselves in such a corner that at this point you almost have to abandon the twist, but they're not smart enough to do it. You know?
Yeah.
That's how bad of a corner. And that should be a scene where, like the Blair Witch Project, where you walk in and he's in the corner. That's what that scene's supposed to be. Right. And the actors are giving you that, but the director and the writer, whoever else involved with the storytelling, took all the tension out of it, and instead you just get basically two actors becoming embarrassed.
Yeah, it's just so obvious. It's just so stupidly obvious, and they just look so dumb. The movie just turns on them and makes them look so stupid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We should all have our jaws on the floor at this moment. You know, we should all just be in horror, like, oh my God, I can't believe this happened. And you're not. You're like, you saw this. You knew what was happening. And they didn't. And it just makes them look pathetic rather than shocked or feeling shock on their behalf. They just look really, really stupid.
And I ended up just, what I did during the movie was, is Peter Sarsgaard related to the Skarsgards? Or maybe I got it backwards. So I'm Googling who's related and who's not. And that's what this movie did to me. He's not related, by the way. That's spelled totally different.
Yeah.
Let's move on to, I really don't know what better means. I guess anything's better, but let's just go to Daddy's Girl.
Daddy's Girl. Thinking of movies with twists. Daddy's Girl is about a movie starring Gemma Dallander as Zoe and Costas Mandalore as John Stone. John Stone is a serial killer who uses his daughter, Zoe, to lure women back to their home where he can take them into his torture chamber and kill them. He's also having sex with his daughter on a regular basis. So super gross stuff. They catch the eye of a cop played by Jesse Moss, who recognizes John Stone as this guy who may have been torturing people in Iraq. And he sets about kind of beginning to investigate them. Meanwhile, John Stone's kind of going up, breaking his own rules and kind of hunting for women in their backyard. And he begins to hunt this one, Jennifer, played by Brett McKillop. And that's where the story is going from there. She has a secret of her own that gets revealed, but it's all pretty clumsy and not very interesting. Daddy's Girl is not a very good movie. It's got some interesting elements. It's got some interesting stylistic choices. But there's just not really much there. There's nothing really exciting about this presentation of it. Costas Mandalore is not a very interesting villain. He's not a very interesting actor to begin with. He was good in the Saw movies because he's very functional in the Saw movies. He's not really necessarily supposed to be the most interesting character. He's a function of Jigsaw, and that's kind of the best place for him. So having him be front and center as the big bad, he's just not interesting enough. Gemma Dallander is much better. She's a much more interesting actor, but the choices that they make, the first time we see her, she's sitting at a table with a gun in front of her and looking like she's about to take her own life, and that pays off about 25, 30 minutes later. Like, why is that the opening of the movie? Why do we start here? It's a lot of weird choices and not a very good movie.
Yeah, clumsy is a good word for it. Like you said, there's decent ideas that maybe could have been executed better. But yeah, when you basically bring the function guy in Saw to be the main guy. He's basically playing Jigsaw here. I mean, they're not pretending like they're not trying to be Saw with having him in this movie and doing torture scenes. I mean, the acting is pretty atrocious from the cop.
Yeah.
And it just, I don't know. The ending had potential. You know, it's a neat kind of idea, but, you know, and you keep looking for ways to make it work. One, this movie we never would have watched if we weren't in quarantine. And two, you know, this movie, if it was made by a good, skilled director with no budget, would have been awesome. You know, they would have found a way to make that mean something, you know, really pull off the ending in kind of an artistic way, and where you're conflicted whether you like it or not because it's so dark, but at the same time, they won you over. I don't know. It's just kind of a piece of shit in a lot of ways.
It's really sad. It's sad and pathetic too, because they really believe in what they're doing, because they're setting up a sequel. they take the ending and they use the ending to set up a sequel, and it's like, oh no, that's not, honey, that's never going to happen. You're never going to have a sequel.
Yeah. I mean, this is something like an early Abel Ferrara movie could have possibly pulled off. I would have liked to seen that potentially. You know, I hesitate after Kings of New York or whatever.
Right.
But still, I mean, I could see a Miss 45 coming out of something like this, or, you know, with that kind of style into this movie would have been something to see.
This doesn't have that kind of nerve to it. This is just this is more about presenting violence as opposed to using it in an effective manner.
Yep. Yeah, it's definitely Saw lights with no plot. No good plot, at least.
Just so sad watching people, though, think, oh, well, this is such a good thing. Now we're going to set up the sequel. Ready, girls?
Well, and then you throw on top of that the fact that, you know, we're watching this movie when we normally wouldn't have had to. And so then you get the real world depression that goes with watching this that gets added to your experience. Like, I could be in the theater right now watching something awesome. A24 is supposed to be dropping movies every other week this time of year. Instead, we're stuck with the horror movies that we have to watch here and there.
And we still haven't watched First Cow.
I mean, it's available. I keep flirting with hitting Rent. I mean, at least it's been available every week, but I hate wasting time. which I don't think it's a waste of time, but I mean, for the podcast, I want to get as much in as possible. And I didn't get two of the next three in. It sounds like I'm going to regret one of them, but probably not this one, Cage Fighter.
Cage Fighter stars an actual MMA guy whose name escapes me, but also John Moxley from AEW, the former Dean Ambrose from the WWE. He plays the big bad guy in this movie. But where do I begin with Cage Fighter? This isn't a movie. They think it's a movie. They act like it's a movie. It's not really much of a movie. The idea here is that they've got this champion MMA guy who isn't even credited on their IMDb. He's like 15 characters down on their IMDb. Alex Bontagnani, who is an actual MMA guy. He's the world champion of Legends MMA, run by Gina Gershon. And she decides to book him in a fight with a professional wrestler, Robert Stone, or Randy Stone, played by Moxley. And the wrestler beats him. And when he beats him, he basically takes this entire guy's career. So he takes he loses all of his promotional stuff. He loses a movie role because he got beat so badly by this professional wrestler. He loses everything. And then he goes into another fight and loses. And then he's got to try and get back into a fight with Moxley's character and see if he can get his dignity back. And all of this is presented. There's like 45 minutes of super violent fight scenes. Fight scenes that are so violent that, like, they don't even a real MMA fight doesn't look as violent as this does. This is like the Black Knight from Monty Python levels of fighting, where this guy's just getting his ass kicked so badly that you would think he'd be dead as opposed to just in an MMA fight. And The rest of the movie is basically one of those hype packages for a pay-per-view fight, but stretched to like 45 minutes in length. So it's like, here's my background, and here are the things that I have to overcome in order to make it to this fight. And it's so dumb, and the presentation is so bad. And his movie just overall is just bad. Moxley is not terrible. I mean, he does his job. He's basically just playing an angry John Moxley in an MMA version instead of a wrestling ring. And I, frankly speaking, if you want to enjoy, you know, John Moxley, in a fake fight, just watch him at Lights Out against Kenny Omega for 45 minutes. That is 10 times more compelling than anything in Cage Fighter. They've got a barbed wire bed in that match. I mean, come on. There's no barbed wire bed in this match. this isn't any good at all, and really not worth anybody's time.
Yeah, I read your review and I figured that was enough. I mean, I was mildly curious just because John Moxley was in it. But at the same time, that not that curious. And when basically, I think one of the lines you had was, if you've seen a movie, you know how this where this goes. So I was kind of like, oh, I've seen a movie, so I'm good. But then your description of it being just a hype piece for 45 minutes. I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about. The Rockies did those, and they did montages, I guess, a little different. But at least those are fun, and you want to work out.
Well, there's an actual movie around the boxing in Rocky. You know, you've got actual character development that is really interesting. And you're actually, you know, like, repeatedly we're told things about this guy, and we're told things about him over and over again. And that's not good in filmmaking. Rocky, you actually get to see Rocky do what Rocky does, and you actually get to see Rocky where he is and how he grows as a person. And through the experiences that he's having with Talia Shire, his wife. And that's interesting. And that's character development. There's none of that here, because we're constantly just told things about this guy.
Yeah. So, yeah, it sounds like a good one to skip.
This has got one of my favorite new tropes, though. Do you know the Poochie trope?
No.
So Poochie was Homer Simpson's character on The Simpsons. His character on Itchy and Scratchy was Poochie. And Poochie became this big hit on Itchy and Scratchy show on The Simpsons. And so Homer got this big head and he became very arrogant. And he talks to the producers about how when Poochie's not on the screen, people need to be talking about Poochie. And there's this great Poochie character in Cage Fighter where you never see this guy on screen, but everybody talks about him and how great he is. And you're like, okay, we're going to see him? No. You don't see him. They just talk about how great he is.
That's funny.
Oh, I love it.
I was just watching this morning. I couldn't sleep, so I got up really early, and I was going down the old Eddie Van Halen rabbit hole, and I was watching a documentary on a VH1 documentary, so call it what you want, of Sammy and Dave, kind of when they did that tour together, and it kind of sounds like David Lee Roth when he was in, when I'm not on stage, you better be talking about me.
Yeah, Dave is the ultimate Poochie.
All right. Let's talk about Miss White Light.
Yes. One of the best movies of the year. And I say that with, I know I've said that about H is for Happiness, which I still think is absolutely my favorite movie of the year. And She Dies Tomorrow. But this one, the more I spend time thinking about this movie, the more I'm with this movie, the more I love it. This is a very, and I think a lot of that has to do with me wanting to see movies that aren't like every other movie. And this is so not like any other movie. And I just love that. So the story here is that this woman played by Roberta Calandra, Lexi, she has this very unique talent where she sits down at the bedsides of people who are dying. And through whatever means, she's actually able to talk them through their own death to the point where they're actually able to comfortably accept dying. And it's not necessarily a supernatural gift, but we're not really, the movie doesn't really go into whether or not there's a supernatural element to what she does. But it's really interesting. But she's She's really such a unique character. She's so not comforting in any other aspect of her life. Like, she can comfort dead people, but then immediately after, she turns into like Sheldon from the Big Bang Theory levels of uncomfortable around people because she hates the family of dead people. Because they don't know how to talk to their own person, their family member who's dying. They don't know how to do it, so they hire her, and she resents them for hiring her. But at the same time, she's committed to helping these people because she knows what she does has value in helping people accept death. So the story takes a turn when she meets this character played by Judith Light, who is this woman dying of cancer who doesn't appear to need any help. She's this very rich woman who's hired pretty much anybody who's in the field of life after death to come visit her regularly and just talk to her, so she can just kind of like a death tourism bureau. Like, she's just kind of exploring the various different aspects of death. And it just drives Lex crazy that this woman doesn't have the kinds of traits that a dying person usually has that she can actually help people with. And that dynamic is wonderful. And she's introduced into that dynamic this psychic who he knows he's a fraud. Lex knows he's a fraud. Judith Light knows he's a fraud. And Judith Light and he are just okay. They're friendly about it. And they're having a wonderful conversation. It is driving Lex crazy. And Roberta Calandra is so great at being frustrated by these characters around her. She's so funny doing it. The scenes that they have, I'm talking about it like a broad comedy, but it's not a broad comedy because they also take death very seriously. Like, there's a lot of gravity to death. And when death does arrive, the couple times that it does, it's taken very seriously and the tragedy is really felt. And I just love that this movie is so smart and so adept at transitioning from a very light comic tone to a very serious examination of sadness and grief. It's so wonderful, just so well directed. And there's so many great directorial touches, like film language to this, that is really, really fantastic. There's this wonderful scene where the psychic Spencer and Lex are standing in a hallway, and it looks like they're going to start on a new type of friendship. Like, they've come to a new understanding. The camera pulls back and we see people run past them, and there's a tragedy unfolding with one of the other characters. And Lex pushes past the camera. The camera follows her, stops at another character, turns around. She walks out of the room, and you get this perfect shot. Spencer in the distance, another one of our characters in the forefront, and this tragedy unfolding next to him. And it's just this perfect cinematic moment. It's maybe my favorite moment of any movie in terms of direction this year. I love this movie.
Picked the perfect week to watch it too, with Phoebe the Lie, Daddy's Girl, Cage Fighter, and even the next movie we're going to talk about, because like they all kind of are derivatives of other movies.
So true.
So that definitely. I wish I would have watched this. I forgot about it, and then I was reading through our text conversation, and I saw it. I'm like, oh shit, I don't have time. Well, I had time, but I don't. At like 11 o'clock at night, if I'm laying in bed watching something on my phone, I'm going to try to watch the free stuff. No offense. I don't want to.
Yeah, yeah. Pay for something you fall asleep to.
Right. Not that it's that big of a deal, but still. This next movie I started, turned off. You kind of made a comment, so I started it again. American Pie, Girls Rule.
American Pie presents Girls Rules.
Correct. My fault.
Because this is, I was told that this was supposed to be canon, but I don't know if it's canon now. It might have been taken out of the canon now. We're back to essentially with the original premise, but gender flipped. So we've got four female characters, all of them trying to have sex or have had sex and conversations about sex. And yeah, it's basically the first movie, but with girls.
Can I say this, though? This is going to sound like the most sexist thing in the whole world, but the girls in the original American Pie had better character arcs than the males in this movie did. You know what I'm saying? At least, you know, they kind of mattered in that movie. Here, they're just kind of, you know, they're what really the American Pie presents Naked Mile or Band Camp. They're kind of the equivalent of the girls in those movies.
I think part of the problem there is, though, is Darren Barnett. He's given a role that is way beyond him. He plays Grant, who is the guy that all four of the girls are kind of not pursuing, but are pursuing, is kind of just, he's presented as something that each of them might want, depending upon the situation. If they can't get another guy, this is the guy that they're going to focus on. And he's not really compelling enough as an actor to hold up to that. Nothing in this movie is particularly good enough to hold up to that idea. But I really like Lizzie Broadway, who plays Stephanie Stifler in this movie. She has a wonderful energy. And I thought she captured some of the best aspects of that legendary Stifler character from the first film and the second film. Whether you like Sean William Scott's character or not, and he's probably the weakest element of the original movie, but I like the way that she's capitalized upon who that character was, making that character a woman and giving her so much forward energy sexually, comically. I really enjoyed that. I thought she really nailed this. She's the best part of this for me.
Yeah, I have nothing really against this movie other than it's, you have your American Pie movies and you have your American Pie Presents movie, and this is a Presents movie. And I mean, maybe it's the best of all the Present ones. I don't really know. I mean, I've watched them, but
You watched Naked Mile and all those?
I don't know if I watched it. I watched Band Camp, I think. And then I was like, this is dumb. And I don't know. I really don't know what I saw and what I didn't. I couldn't tell you what they're about other than the title. I'm assuming they ran the Naked Mile and Naked Mile, and assuming they went to Band Camp and Band Camp. But
I've not seen any of these I've not seen any of these actually outside of the original cast.
Yeah. I mean, and I think Eugene Levy's in one of them, and I think
that I found weird. If you're going to have one character stick around, that's a weird one to choose.
Right. But I mean, at the same time, like, I feel like the American Pie, the originals were, you know, they were over the top, but they were grounded while being over the top. This is just like so over the top that it never, you know, it just plays at a different level. And so it's harder for me to be into it. Again, there's entertaining parts of it. The girls are the best part of it, obviously. But when you go back to the American Pie movies, I like everybody in it, or I at least I'm invested in some way to every character. And here it's just like the four girls, and then you're supposed to be Grant too, I guess. But the rest are just kind of throwaway characters, and in American Pie, I don't feel like there was any of that. But it's fine. I mean, it's entertaining enough. You're right. The Stifler character is the best in this one, and I think if you were to ask most fans, it would be Jim and Stifler were the two that everybody likes. That's the one they kept those two in every movie, I think.
Yeah,
but you're right, Stifler definitely doesn't age well. But it's necessary. I don't know, we'll get to that one in a minute. But I mean, it's watchable, it's fine. Probably the best of the Presents, but that's not saying much because I haven't seen those.
I think I just had such incredibly low expectations for this movie that it helps me to appreciate it more. I think there's a great deal more effort here than there was, and I'm assuming in the other ones, because anytime you look at those in clips, they just look terrible and they look like really impossibly low effort. And there appears to be a lot of effort to me in this. There's a lot of big, broad, slapstick, gross humor in this that I appreciated, that these female actresses are so game for. I appreciated that they were willing to go as far as they go in humiliating themselves. Madison Pettis, her opening scene is I found that really funny. The lengths to which she was throwing herself around the room and doing horrible things, like she ends up swallowing her diaphragm. I mean, I thought that just her willingness to humiliate herself as much as she does in that opening scene really impressed me. And then when they introduced the Stifler character, she's just completely out there, going completely on to the Sean William Scott energy from the original. I was like, yeah, all right, I like it.
And what I did enjoy too is, like, well, one, in the original there's five guys and there's only four girls here. Stifler's kind of a side character.
Right.
But you couldn't really, other than the Stifler character, you know, I guess the first girl is sort of Jim, but she's also, you know, none of them really are just interchangeable with the original cast. You know, they're kind of their own thing, which I did appreciate. I guess calling it American Pie Presents, I feel like it's a mistake. Call it Girls Rule and be done. You know, if it was Porky's, you know, Presents American Pie back in 1999, maybe we're not looking at American Pie the same, you know? Or if it's The Last Picture Show Presents American Pie. It's just not, you know, you're automatically bringing baggage with it. And I think that was my problem early on, because the acting was so over the top that you could borderline say bad until you realize that's the intent. Once you get into the movie a little more, it's not bad acting. That's what the tone of the movie is supposed to be. So it was more, you know, I just had to get past all that. But just, yeah, call it Girls Rule. Because now you also have that, like when you got annoyed with the Hubie Halloween and how Adam Sandler's really a nice guy, and, you know, you put this undertone of it, well, we just swapped gender, so now it's a girl power movie, and then it doesn't need that pressure either. I mean, it's American Pie Presents movie, for God's sake. So, you know, just make a fun movie and call it Girls Rule and leave the American Pie crap out of it, and I think it would have played better. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's, I don't know, for me at least.
Yeah.
Anything else on American Pie Presents Girls Rule?
It should have been a lot worse than it is, and I think that's affecting my positive take.
Sounds like my opinion of Hubie Halloween. All right. I'm hitting the button and nothing is playing. Let's see. Try this.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized undisputed classic
American Pie.
And yeah, this is inside baseball here. We were going to do Cronenberg week because, you know, Brandon Cronenberg's new movie Possessor was supposed to be out, and then they only put it out in theaters. And so we canceled Scanners as the classic. And because we talked about this last week when we had an American Pie movie this week, it felt appropriate to make this change and kind of look back at American Pie and do the comparison that we were kind of doing last week with Last Picture Show. And obviously this is not nearly as accomplished as that. I think that film is has much more to it than this movie does. But there's an element to this that is actually kind of deepened for me about American Pie. And I'm bringing a lot of that to this. This is obviously there's a lot wrong with it in terms of how this movie is aged, but I find that American Pie and the character of Jim, as played by Jason Biggs, still remains a character that I find relatable and very, very funny. He's this wonderfully pathetic, sweet character who has a typically teenage goal. He just wants to have sex. There's a purity to that goal on his part, just as a teenager, just as a pathetic loser teenager that I can respect. Could you make this movie today? I don't know. But as it is, four guys trying to have sex and how they grow on the way to get there. And there's a little bit more depth there than I think a lot of people have ever given this movie credit for. Because each of these characters do grow throughout. Like, they do learn to become better people on their way to getting the thing that they want. So there's that. And then there's a lot of really, you know, sick, gross out stuff.
Right. I mean, I think a lot of what the problem is we're in the middle of kind of a era in our culture where we're trying to include more than just white males. And
yeah, that's
as a white male movie, this works perfect. Even the stuff that doesn't age well at least puts you in a mindset that you were once in at some point on your own, you know?
Right.
Even, you know, the internet scene where she's stripping naked and they're broadcasting it. I'm not going to pretend like that, you know, that isn't hot and exciting, but at the same time, it's horribly wrong, you know? And there's, you know, so I'm okay with that, you know, with that being represented, because that would be a thought that guys would have. You know, I feel like I kind of recognize myself with a lot of these characters, not just Jim, but a little bit of Oz. I mean, Stifler not so much, but maybe, you know, jokes in your head that you don't say out loud. I mean, I'm not going to pretend like they haven't popped in my head before, but I've never acted that way.
Mm-hmm.
Never Kevin. I don't know why. I have no relationship to him.
That's my roommate. Kevin's kind of the weakest character of all.
And he was kind of the biggest star
part of the movie
in.
Too.
Right. He's like the biggest star going into this thing. And then everybody blows up afterwards except for him. Like everybody in this movie became a star for a while. But and so as a white male movie, this I think is very, very good and it works very, very well. But it, at the same time, what came after it all kind of sucked. You know, it did spawn a bunch of movies that were kind of shit. Mm-hmm. With a lot of this cast in those movies.
I like American Pie too, and
I like American Wedding too.
I think they're both really funny.
I agree completely. I'm talking about the wannabe American Pie movies.
Okay, yeah.
With Freddie Prinze Jr. And you know, a lot of these guys are in those movies, and
yeah.
But no, I think I actually watched American Pie 2 after this because it was free, so I watched both of them there. But you know, I feel compelled to say as a white male movie, this is great. I do think they care about the women in this movie. All of them went on to be stars as well, and mm-hmm. I think their characters matter. And they're not at the forefront, but they're still you care about them.
They're not objects. You know, no. They're not goals to be accomplished. You know, they do have scenes of their own, and they're the reason why these guys do become better people by the end.
And you miss them in the second movie and third movie when they're not there. You're wondering about them at least in the other movies.
Yeah.
So I really think it's quite good. But I got to separate myself from you know. Obviously, I don't necessarily need a movie with someone like Stifler or that internet stripping scene and all that. But that's real, and it definitely was at that time. I mean, we didn't know how. You know, what we would be able to do with phones and stuff and how bad right. It's gotten. But at the time, it seemed cool and exciting. And obviously, now it's really horrible and borderline sexual assault, if not past borderline.
Right. At the time, though, I mean, our model for this type of thing, like Revenge of the Nerds, they put a camera in the girls' bedrooms there in that movie, and it's not to justify either one. They're both, you know, essentially sexual violations, but at the time it seemed innocent at the time because we were the ones in charge,
right?
As men, we get to decide what's offensive and you don't, and that's kind of where this movie exists in that time frame. And it was not okay then, it's not okay now, but it was still, it felt like it was okay at the time for some reason.
And I think it's okay to talk about wondering about it, you know,
we need to reckon with it. We need to reckon with how we felt at that time. And all of us need to understand, right. You know, why we laughed at the time and why it was not why it wasn't okay, really.
Right. And that's why, I mean, I'm okay
you
with
you can have the two thoughts where you're laughed at this and it was funny to you, and also come around and understand why it was wrong. And whether the movie understands that or not, obviously it probably doesn't, but we can grow as people and come to understand that.
And I think as you watch the American Pie movies go on, the Stifler character becomes more and more. I mean, he never really was the star of the movie. He wasn't necessarily the cool guy. He was always kind of the guy you were laughing at, even though
he gets comeuppance too at times. You know, he gets, you know, he's when he gets it in the end, you know, you laugh because he's kind of a villain character.
Right. And it gets worse and worse throughout the series of movies. And so, I mean, I don't know. I really enjoyed it way more than I thought I would. And I mean, I watched it. Literally, it was American Pie Girls Rule, American Pie 2. And you could tell they were making a blockbuster. I don't know how they knew, but you had hit songs. And maybe they weren't hits before they made the movie, but literally every song in this movie became a hit. Hmm. You had a cast of characters that you cared about. They all went on to become stars. In the second one as well, it's really you could tell there was care. They were making the next movie to be a trendsetter, and they accomplished that then. And I think it deserves it. And you know, Judd Apatow came out later on, and he's changed the trend again. So it, I don't know, it deserved the credit it got, and It held up well enough because it reminded me of me back then. And I guess I just had the conversation with myself that you were just talking about, and I appreciated that about this movie, even if it was unintentional.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else on American Pie?
I still enjoy it. There's still, obviously, there's some going to be some regressive elements about any movie that, as you go on, you know, 21 years later, you're going to find regressive elements to it. But it's not about forgiving those regressive elements or pretending they're not there. It's about learning from them and being okay with learning from them. And we're not going to cancel American Pie. It's not going to get canceled. And these people who worry about, oh, well, if you talk about that scene and you're critical of it, you're canceling the movie. No, we're learning from it. We're learning from what we were and growing to where we are and getting better.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it last week, but cancel culture is so bullshit. It's everybody who cancels something, they're canceling it individually, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, you may.
And you're allowed to do that. You're allowed to not like this movie. Guess what? Yeah. You're allowed to look at American Pie and be offended by it and not enjoy it. And that's fine. It's not canceled. And this it's so frustrating. These people who talk about cancel culture can't hold two thoughts in their head at the same time.
Did you watch Bill Burr's opening monologue?
I did not. I've heard things about it, and I'm just avoiding it because I just don't even want to bother.
I mean, he's a comedian, so I want to give him the benefit of the doubt by joking, but it's just kind of like, yeah, but that's not real. I mean, you're not going anywhere.
He's saying this on national television and is going to go tweet about it to his 4 million followers, but he's canceled. Oh, I got canceled because I talked about women. Oh my God. So stupid. It's just so dumb.
Yeah. It's
American Pie is not canceled. And if you tell me, oh, you couldn't make an American Pie movie today, well, they just did, and it's funny.
And I think you could make it. Maybe it wouldn't be the exact same, but this movie could still exist. I don't want to see it at the moment because I'm sick of, you know, we just kind of talked about it earlier. I mean, we've had The Hangover later on, and I don't need it. I'm starting to feel uncomfortable with white guy comedies. You know, I want...
Yeah.
You know, I just want something else for a while. You know, let us go away for 10, 20 years. Then maybe you can do it again. That's more than anything. What's the worst thing? Well,
we were talking before about the sameness of the way that movies are all so very much the same. And the reason that is because for decade upon decade, every movie came from the perspective of a white man in his 30s, 40s, 50s, controlling every single narrative from the screenplay to the direction. That breeds sameness. And sometimes things get outside of that. And even a white guy can have a different idea and be unique, like Ari Aster. Very unique ideas, exploring very unique aspects of society through female characters, through male characters, just through telling a good story. Because he doesn't give a fuck about any of that other shit. And anybody can tell a good story, but when you have this overarching thing where every movie is made by a white guy, you're going to breed the kind of sameness that drives me insane and makes for a lot of really terrible movies.
Yeah. And when this came out, it hadn't happened in a while. You know, the 80s kind of ran that Porky's thing into the ground, and the 90s went away from it. And then at the end, they came out with this, and it brought it back for a while. Mm-hmm. And so you just need a break. And I haven't gotten farther enough away from this that I can still go back to this one and be fine. But I just need a break before we get another, before, you know, Todd Phillips can do another good comedy or whatever. Go do your Joker stuff. That's, you know, you evolve too. You know, mm-hmm. I don't need it right now because I'm sick of it. I need to breathe a little bit. All right.
If I never hear another white guy tell me on national television how they're not allowed to say the things that they are saying on national television.
While they're saying it.
you're literally fucking saying it.
Oh, man. All right. 1990. You watched Welcome Home, Roxy Carmichael?
Yes. Winona Ryder stars alongside Jeff Daniels in the story of a small town in Indiana that has one celebrity by the name of Roxy Carmichael, and they have tailored their entire town around Roxy with various different things dedicated to her house. In town is a historic landmark. She is the Poochie of this universe. When she's off screen, everybody has to talk about her, and she's never on screen. We never actually meet Roxy in the entire movie. Spoiler alert. But everybody is constantly talking about Roxy. She is the ultimate Poochie. She's coming home for a celebration of her, and it's been 15 years since she's been there, and she's become very, very famous for a reason that absolutely makes no sense. The idea that Jeff Daniels explains is that she was the subject of a very popular song, and the singer of the song became this massive rock star and gave her the song, and the song made her rich, and also their love story became like this national obsession that made her a celebrity. So she's not a movie star, she's not a singer, she doesn't really have any talents. She kind of actually presages the whole reality TV thing, really, when you think about it. But so Roxy's coming home. She's been gone for 15 years. When she left, she'd had a baby with Jeff Daniels and left the baby behind, and Jeff Daniels gave the baby up. And this character played by Winona Ryder, Dinky, believes that she is that baby because she was adopted and brought back to this town and was living in this town for the past 15 years. She thinks she's that baby. She's convinced of it. And throughout, she's just kind of dealing with her. She's a very weird character. She's kind of goth, but not. She's got a boyfriend, but not. She's just kind of got a lot of very odd energies, get a very conflict with her parents and so on. And she thinks that her entire life is built up to this. And that's basically where everybody is kind of defined in this movie by their relationship to Roxy and what Roxy represents and what is missing in their life. Which is an interesting idea, but the movie really is too surface level to really get in and explore that idea with anybody other than Dinky. And they keep presenting all these characters, like Dinah Manoff is in this movie, and she plays a character who was Roxy's best friend, and she has no plot at all other than she's angry that Roxy's coming back, and she might be gay. Like, there's this whole running thread that really has no purpose, but she's maybe sleeping with her friend in town, and she may have had a sexual relationship with Roxy in the past, and they don't ever comment on it at all. Specifically, they just hint at it, and you're kind of left to wonder why it's there, and then it goes unresolved in the end. This is a weird movie with so many weird elements too. There's this character who's a guidance counselor who takes a liking to Dinky, wants to be there for her, and is the one person in the movie who everybody else is like a bully to her, aside from maybe her dad, who's just more of he's just kind of absent and kind of absent-minded. He's a good guy who loves his daughter, but not there. And so this guidance counselor takes to her and becomes her friend. And they have this very weird scene that you could not do today because the implications are really bizarre and oddly sexual. So she takes Dinky on a shopping trip to Cleveland, takes her out of school for the day. So here you have a completely unrelated person from school, an older woman taking a younger woman from school with no permission to go shopping. And they go shopping and they're changing in the same change room. And Dinky just takes her clothes off in front of her and asks her if she likes her boobs. And the woman goes, yes, you have wonderful boobs. And they go on, and that's it. That's all that happens. But there's this weird tension in the scene that is not commented upon. And that happens, like I said, with the Dinah Manoff character. And then you have this scene, and nobody actually says anything. They just sort of present this. They just sort of shove this at you. They throw this aspect at you with nothing, with no commentary, with no underlying purpose. And it's just awkward and weird, and you're just kind of scratching your head at it. And it makes the movie weirdly fascinating, at the same time a complete failure, because this movie doesn't really have any kind of purpose in the end.
Is it a parody at all? Because it's made by Jim Abrams, right?
No, there's no parody aspect at all. Yes, it is one of the American Airplane guys, yes, Abrams. But no, there's no element of parody whatsoever.
Huh. Yeah, I thought about watching this one, but American Pie 2 is free.
I don't know what to make. Am I crazy? That's a crazy thing that happens between her and the guidance counselor, right?
Well, yeah.
I agree.
In real life, she's kidnapped this girl, and this girl is showing her her breasts, and she's just kind of like, whatever.
Yeah.
And again, it's supposed to be kind of like, she's like looking for any element of having a real mom, because she and her mom, her adopted mom is played by Frances Fisher, and they don't get along at all. They hate each other, and they don't have a typical mother-daughter relationship. So you can sense that Dinky is desperate to have that kind of parental interaction that maybe other girls have had. So there's that element to it, but it's presented in a way that is that instead makes it awkward and sexual. And I don't understand how anybody thought any of that was a good idea.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know if that's me being 2020 or if that was me. Would I have thought that at the time? I don't know.
That's what I was going to say and wonder. I mean, I don't know, because I can't. When I go back to these movies, it's like, okay, I guess I was 9, but I felt older. I mean, because a lot of them I watched when I was older. And then there's other ones just like, how was this come out the same year that Goodfellas came out? You know, it seemed like such a different era. And so this has been a weird year of the 30-year movies for me. This has been the weirdest of all of them. Like 89, I still recognize myself as a kid.
Right.
This is where it really, I'm just so conflicted.
Because, I mean, it's been 30 years. We've gone back in time, and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is the biggest standout. Like, what is going on in the world?
Right. I feel like in 89, a lot of those movies I still watched at that age. In 1990, a lot of these movies I ended up watching later on. I mean, I clearly didn't watch Goodfellas when I was 9.
No.
But Miller's Crossing or whatever else. But so it's just been just oddly confusing is the way I'll describe it.
That's why I love the 30-year movies. That's why I love doing this. Is this you get a sense of what the world was like then and the world is like now and how bizarre it all is and how, you know, there are movies like Goodfellas that could come out today. You could release Goodfellas today and it would still feel, it would be the same movie.
Right.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles really could be the same movie today.
Better.
And yet you watch a movie like Roxy Carmichael and it can't exist outside of 1990.
Right.
And that's the weird sort of odd juxtaposition of these 30-year movies.
Yeah, and I'm getting to that age where now from here on out, it's just going to be odd. Because, like, literally yesterday, it felt like 1993. So I don't realize it's only 12. You know, I felt like I was older. But anyway. What else came out this week? Oddly enough, I'd imagine you didn't watch this. I didn't. Troll 2. I figured we'd do a big thing on Troll 2, and I just avoided it.
So have you never seen it, or have you
seen it? I mean, and I saw the documentary about it, and but I mean, yeah, okay, it's the best worst movie ever, that's fine. I don't know, the documentary kind of stands out more to me than the movie because of how much the director didn't realize it was bad, and I almost felt bad for him when everybody was like, they're literally doing this convention where they're making fun of the movie, and he's thinking they're celebrating it.
Yeah, he's not like Tommy Wiseau, where Tommy has the self-awareness to kind of shift. Oh, yes, I intended comedy. Yes, that's what I meant. This guy does not have that.
Right. And it makes it less fun, you know? Like, you know, I don't know. He really thought he was making a work of art, and it's just more, you feel bad for the guy when they're making fun of it. But I mean, yeah, it's bad. And then you also throw in the fact that it came out in 1990. That just throws me for a loop too. It's like,
it this looks like it came out in the 70s.
No shit. And that's, I kind of thought it came out in like the early 80s or something like that.
Yeah. Because it's the whole production looks so old. It looks so much older than 1990. Everything down to the character design. I mean, just the actual, like, the dressing of the characters feels older than 1990. And I mean, I just watched, you know, like I said, I just watched Roxy Carmichael, and you know, that the fashion there isn't very 1990, but it feels like of that moment. Whereas the fashion in this movie that came out in the same year feels like it's about 10 years behind that.
Yeah.
And I don't understand how this is. Why are they trolls? And everybody's been down that that rabbit hole about why it's called Trolls, but they're set. It's about goblins. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. The Hot Spot, the Dennis Hopper film that helped me.
I did not get to that one.
You've seen it, though, right?
Or, have I?
I mean, don't remember. This kind of got me through my teenage years. Crush on Jennifer Connelly.
Oh, okay.
You've definitely seen clips. Yeah. I'm sure you've seen clips of it.
Yeah. My Mr. Skin, that expired a long time ago.
But when you had it. I'm sure it's still up there as a go-to clip.
I imagine, yeah.
Memphis Belle, Mr. Destiny, and To Sleep With Anger. I know I've seen Mr. Destiny because my dad was always... That's kind of a dad movie.
It does seem like a dad movie. What's the premise of that one?
It's basically It's a Wonderful Life set over baseball and Jim Belushi instead of Jimmy Stewart. He basically has to... He gets to relive what life would be like if he hit the game-winning home run as a kid. So they kind of replay his life. I don't really remember it. This is from going off of reading the premise.
Yeah.
I remember being on when I was a kid. A lot of the Jim Belushi movies were on when I was a kid. But I don't... Yeah, it sounds kind of dumb.
Hmm.
Especially when you
thought... Memphis Belle is a World War II movie, I believe, with Matthew Modine. But it's been 30 years since I've seen it.
Yeah, and To Sleep With Anger stars Danny Glover. And if it was good, I'm sure I would have heard about it before, being that it stars Danny Glover, and I like Danny Glover. next week, we got Totally Under Control, a movie Sean has seen.
Mm-hmm.
Possessors, another movie Sean has seen.
Yep.
Shit House, The Trial of the Chicago 7, and Clouds. That's Disney Plus, you said?
Yes, that'll be on Disney Plus. I don't know what it is, though.
We're going to attempt to do Scanners again as our classic, especially since I've seen it already. and then 1990, we have Reversal of Fortune, The Night of the Living Dead remake, Quigley Down Under, and White Palace.
I have a funny Quigley Down Under story.
To share now or to save for next?
There's no reason why. I was dating a girl, and she brought me over to her house to meet her parents for the first time, and she explained to me that her parents had a tradition of watching Quigley Down Under, and that just seemed to be the most incongruous thing in the world to me, that anyone would ever have that as a tradition. Like, we watch this movie all the time. What? What this? Why this? What? Yeah, we're gonna watch it right now. Okay, let's watch Quigley Down Under.
Yeah. Oddly enough, I mean, I've never said it on the podcast, but that title pops in my head from time to time since 1990. Because this is kind of the first movie I remember there constantly being ads on like the TV Guide channel or some pay per view channel that I didn't have. Which is like Quigley got Down Under. That title never left me. It was almost kind of like what basically would be if my life was Family Guy, I would have little Quigley Down Under sidebars. Never seen the movie.
I was trying to, all throughout watching the movie, I just kept trying to like headcanon how this became like, was your dad dying or something? And this was the one movie that gave him comfort, and then he survived. And because he survived, they now watch Quigley Down Under regularly. I kept trying to headcanon how it could be that this movie would come so important to a family.
Yeah, because it exists in its own little lane. The Mr. Destiny's, okay, that's a dad. Maybe this is a dad movie, too. I don't know. I've never actually seen it.
I mean, it definitely has a dad movie vibe from Selleck, for sure.
Yeah, I guess he would be. But, I mean... I guess when you say dad movie, but then you're like, well, Clint Eastwood exists and Tombstone came out a little later. So why do you got to go to Tom Selleck? I mean, I don't know. It is fascinating trying to figure out just kind of headcanon in general.
Yeah.
All right. that is our show. If you want to be a Patreon supporter, patreon.com/criticspod, the best way to help support the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to us. Right into the show, it does help us get noticed. We'll try to read reviews when we see them. And then our TeePublic page at ihatecritics.net. Click on the link in the right-hand corner. All right. Do you have time for Flick Chart?
Sure.
I ask every time. We've never not played after I've asked that question. My Girl, 1991. Dune, 1984.
Oh, wow. It's been, I don't know if I've been, I don't know what to say there. Because I don't want to dismiss Dune, but I don't really remember my initial feelings about Dune. And I know we're going to watch it again soon. I don't know. My Girl.
I'm going My Girl. I actually watched that earlier this year. We'll have to watch that next year.
That's one of those. My Girl is one of those movies, like one that keeps popping up for me all the time is Hocus Pocus, that has this bizarre fan base that's kind of almost emerged like organically from women who are now taking over more fandom spaces. You see women now emerging and putting forth their own classics now in a way that we've never seen before. Women our age are now becoming more forceful about their fandom and the things that they loved when they were our age, because so much of our culture is dedicated to things that you and I like. And now we're seeing movies like Hocus Pocus and My Girl are coming around now with their own like fan bases of young women who loved this movie at the time and never really thought to express themselves as a fan base the way that we did around the movies that we loved. And that's kind of fascinating and kind of strange to me, because I don't see what people see in My Girl or Hocus Pocus, but there is this kind of new sort of rising fan base among women our age who are choosing movies like this and Hocus Pocus and creating something around them that I find very fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, I always remembered the big B scene at the end. And to me, it's kind of, this movie begins and ends with that. I mean, the kids are good enough actors, and it's a sad part, you know.
I choke up when I hear it I can still hear it in my head Anna Klumsky saying he needs his glasses. I get choked up a little bit. I do.
And to me, that's what makes this movie good. And Dune, I just feel like, I don't know, part of me wants to go down that rabbit hole and get ready for the movie if it comes out. And another part of me is like, how much time do I have?
Because it is very long.
Well, not just that. I mean, I want to read the books. I don't want to read the books. Maybe go to the Wikipedia pages and read the books there. But that still takes time. And then watch the documentary and the videos. And, you know, it's just watching like parts. I haven't seen the documentary about the original guy who wanted to make Dune.
Yeah,
but I've seen interviews about the documentary and him and stuff, and everything that's come out of his ideas is pretty insane.
Jodorowsky's Dune, there's a lot of big mythical elements to that are really cool.
Well, and all the guys he hired who went on to do like Alien and everything else. I mean, literally every sci-fi movie we've ever seen. I think Star Wars might have come out of that.
Yeah,
just so many things, and it never even happened. It seems fascinating, and I want to dedicate the time to do that, but I don't know if I will or not. Cowboys and Aliens and Stepmom. Speaking of cult movies, that women.
I was this close the other day, about a week and a half ago, writing a new article about Cowboys and Aliens, just because it's one of those things. That exists that should have been the biggest thing ever. You've got James Bond, Han Solo, the director of Iron Man, Western, Aliens. Like, it's as if a marketer just threw up all over this movie. And I thought, how did that not work? And I almost watched it and I didn't, but I just kind of fascinated by that, how that movie has stuck with me not being a very good movie.
But I think you answered your question. It's like a marketer threw up all over it. That usually means it's not good. To me, it's more of a bummer, because I want to sit here and praise Favreau as much as possible, because when he's on, it's as good as it gets. But then there's this, you know, there's, and he's got enough of these out there, or maybe not even these, but he's got the I can't even say it, the third, and movies like Jungle Book. That Jungle Book that aren't horrible, but they're just kind of there.
You want to take his money away.
That's usually what happens, right? He does Elf, and that does great, and then he goes and does Thura, and then he does Iron Man, and then he goes and does Cowboys and Aliens.
Chef.
I need Chef. I want Chef all the time. Give me Chef. Give me Swingers. Even give me Mate. I don't care. I know he didn't direct Swingers, but still. Stepmom, right. Man. I mean, that kind of
Cowboys and Aliens, because I actually hate Stepmom that much.
Isn't Stepmom kind of has its own little female following, too, doesn't it, or no?
It's possible. I've not really seen that much, that one as much, but it's possible. It's in that range, I would say.
I'm gonna flip for it because I know my sister-in-law likes Stepmom, so I want to at least represent her. Okay, Cowboys and Aliens won the flip. Back to the Future Part 3, Shark Tale.
Back to the Future Shark Tale's so forgettable.
I agreed. Space Jam, The Last Seduction. That should be one title.
That's the LeBron James sequel. the Last Seduction.
Okay, I don't remember that one. I mean, I've seen it, but it's been a long time.
It's good. It's very, very good.
Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within, 2001, or While You Were Sleeping?
While You Were Sleeping.
I will go with that as well. The first movie I saw by myself in the theater. That is a weird
Really?
One. Yeah.
Wow.
I wanted to be a Sandra Bullock completist because I like Speed and Demolition Man so much, and then it was just like, this is too much. And The Net and all these. I was like, you know what? I give up. Step Brothers, Top Gun.
Top Gun. I hate Step Brothers.
Thank You for Smoking, Pitch Black.
Thank You for Smoking.
Agreed. Paranormal Activity, Scream 3.
Oh, Paranormal Activity. Scream 3 is the worst. What a piece of crap.
Speaking of, there's another one coming out in January, I think.
Yeah.
The French Connection, Thunderball.
French Connection, reluctantly.
Just because of a Last Picture Show?
Yes.
The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, The Golden Compass.
The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Michael Clayton, The Shining.
The Shining. Michael Clayton's a good movie, though.
Yeah, too straightforward, though, in comparison to The Shining. Beverly Hills Cop, Batman Forever.
Beverly Hills Cop.
Agreed. Crocodile Dundee Part 2, From Russia with Love.
Fuck. From Russia with Love.
I don't care, so yes.
Yeah, I truly don't.
A Knight's Tale, Toy Story.
Toy Story. I love A Knight's Tale, though. Agreed. Guilty pleasure.
Two movies you didn't think you'd say today. Phenomenon, Mighty Ducks Part 2.
Mighty Ducks 2. Phenomenon is just so weepy. Travolta at his worst.
Yeah, thank you, Tarantino. Big Hero 6, White Men Can't Jump.
Big Hero 6 for me, although I appreciate White Men Can't Jump. Big Hero 6, I talked about before, is an underrated movie.
When we watched it initially, I don't think we liked it as much, but I think it has grown over time.
Yeah.
My kids have liked it more, and I've kind of come to appreciate it more as well. I agree. Mission Impossible 3, Run Lola Run.
Run Lola Run, but I'm a fan of Mission Impossible 3.
Agreed. Rambo, First Blood Part 2, Spartacus.
Spartacus.
It's hard for me because Rambo Part 2 is a ton of fun, but Spartacus is a better movie. The Muppet Movie, Child's Play.
The Muppet Movie.
Oh, that could be its own title as well. Clash of the Titans, 2010. Nowhere, 1997. I don't know what that is.
Yeah, I don't recognize Nowhere.
Okay, Zombieland, 2009. Clash of the Titans, 2010.
Easy enough, Zombieland.
Agreed. Black Sheep, 1996. Beetlejuice, 1988.
Beetlejuice.
Yep. The Hunger Games, Catching Fire, Chinatown.
Chinatown. But that's no reflection on Hunger Games.
No. Mimic, 1997. This is not a movie. You remember the Emmanuel movies?
Oh, God, yes.
One of those.
I'm ashamed to say how many Emmanuel movies I've seen.
I don't know if I ever actually...
I watched her go to space once.
That was the one. It was Emmanuel in space versus Mimic. But I'm not going to let... We're not going to use that. If a Red Shoe Diary movie pops up, we're not counting that either. Mimic versus Orange County.
Orange County.
Ray, Hard Rain.
Ray.
Babylon 5, The Legend of the Rangers. That's not a movie, is it?
No.
All right. That's Mercury Rising. That's not a movie, is it? Love Actually. Mercury Rising versus Love Actually.
Love Actually.
Triple X, Primal Fear with Richard Gere.
Primal Fear.
The American President, 101 Dalmatians, 1996.
The American President.
That's kind of the ultimate dad movie right there. The Man with the Golden Gun, Black Snake Moan.
Black Snake Moan.
I agree. My internet decided to slow down, which made me not saying anything really awkward. Usually I just move on. Exit Through the Gift Shop. I don't know what that is. That is. Or The Green Mile.
That's the Banksy. That's the Banksy documentary.
Is that any good?
Did you not see that?
No, I did not.
It's really good. I would enjoy it more than the Green Mile.
I enjoy a lot of things more than The Green Mile. American Werewolf in London, 1408.
Oh, man. You know, it's weird. As I was reading my 1408 review, I found out I really, really like that movie.
The way to turn off my phone's protector, you know, the password is 1408, only because I can remember it because of the movie. I don't necessarily love the movie or not. You know, I don't remember it that much. I'd have to go back and read a review to know if I do or not. But it's just, I don't know, it was a random four digits that I could remember that I hadn't used before. My kids memorized, so
yeah.
My brother's like, why the hell did you use that? But I'm going to go
1408.
Go American Werewolf in London just due to the status it has, but you win the coin toss. Heaven Can Wait, Mad Max.
Heaven Can Wait.
I agree. Scott Pilgrim versus the World, Karate Kid Part 3.
Scott Pilgrim.
Agreed. The Little Mermaid, About a Boy.
About a Boy.
I have to flip. I know it's sacrilege, but I have a soft spot for Little Mermaid. You win again. Event Horizon, Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban.
Harry Potter.
I'll just go with you. I need to rewatch it. It's not fair to pick it just out of spite. The Fountain, Oasis of Zombies.
Never heard of Oasis of Zombies.
Hell of a title, though. Super 8 or The Fountain?
Super 8.
Adventureland, Eastern Promises.
That's tough. That's a tough one.
Yeah.
Man, I liked both of those movies a lot. For very different reasons, obviously.
Hopefully.
Man, I don't know what to say about that. Honestly, I really don't. Because I could pick either one of those movies and be very happy. I could watch either one right now. And
yeah, I guess for me, because I tend to go dark first before I go happy, I usually would probably go Eastern Promises. But you're right. They're both phenomenal movies.
Flip the coin then. We'll split right on it and let the coin decide.
Eastern Promises. The Maltese Falcon, Casablanca.
Not Casablanca.
Okay, I was really torn. I think you're right. I like the Maltese Falcon a lot though. Men in Black 2, The Sixth Day. Two movies at the same level as Casablanca and the Maltese Falcon.
Oh god. Men in Black 2 sucks and it's still better than The Sixth Day.
Oh shit. The Hobbit, The Battle of Five Armies, Backdraft.
Backdraft.
See, Backdraft feels like it existed in 1990 and it didn't.
It does. It's
so weird.
Yeah.
MASH 1970, Inglourious Bastards 2009.
Inglourious Bastards. So MASH needs to be a classic sometime.
I agree. All Dogs Go to Heaven, Spartacus.
Spartacus.
Batman Forever, Miami Vice.
Miami Vice. I just heard a story about Miami Vice randomly on YouTube about Jamie Foxx was angry with the producers, and actually he and Michael Mann didn't get along on that movie because Michael Mann wanted to shoot a scene in Puerto Rico in a ghetto that was controlled by gang members where people were being killed. And Jamie Foxx says, no, I'm not going to go there. And Michael Mann goes, well, we're going to go film there. And like, Jamie Foxx is like, I'm not even going to leave America with you if you think you're going to film scenes like this. And so they had to refilm the entire ending of Miami Vice in America instead of going to where Michael Mann wanted to go because it was too dangerous.
Jesus, that's hilarious. I mean, it sounds like something a up his own ass director would do.
But it's also funny because we're talking about Miami Vice and they were talking about shooting the ending of the movie, not in Miami.
Well, right. There's that too.
Good for Jamie Foxx. I'm with him on that.
But it gives you a little bit of insight into, like, directors are hiding behind cameras a lot. So there's just a sense of reality that doesn't exist. You know,
yeah.
I was listening to Ari Aster on a podcast. I'm not going to tell you which one because he'll be upset. It was Eli Ross podcast, but he wasn't on it. It was the History of Horror that he does for whatever AMC, and they interviewed in long form Ari Aster, and he is like this really bad fear of dying, and he's a hypochondriac, and that's part of why he makes the movies he does and the way he does it. And he was saying Cronenberg's is, you know, one of his biggest influences because the way that human bodies fail in his movies.
Yeah. Just, oh man.
Fuck,
wow.
Fuck him up. And I don't know. It just kind of a lot of insight into why he directs the way he directs. He kind of looks at his movies as comedies rather than horror movies, which is really weird.
I love that.
I know, but he fucking kills a kid. And I mean, I don't know. But it also, though, I mean, he was behind the marketing of it so that, you know, they put that girl out in front as this is what's going to be, you know, the star of the movie and the biggest, you know, possibly what's, you know, you're questioning in the movie. And then they do the psycho thing with her midway through. That was all, you know, he had a hand in all that. So that's pretty phenomenal.
That's awesome. And, you know, people, I early on in my critical career, I used to get so much hate mail from people when I would talk about trailers and marketing. I would talk about it a lot in early reviews where I'd go into how the marketing and the commercials and the trailer make a big difference in how you perceive the movie. And when it doesn't, when those two perceptions don't match, it's a terrible thing and it can ruin a movie. And people are like, why don't you just watch the movie? And I'm like, I tried to just watch the movie. They created the wrong perception of their movie.
Yeah, I care too much about movies to be like that. You know, a casual fan who doesn't really give a shit, they can go watch a Gerard Butler movie all day long and it doesn't matter. But you're right. That's the I love when the director has more say. I to this day, I think Unbreakable was the best marketing ever because it was just literally the name. And that's all you got. You didn't get any. There was no clips of the movie. I had no idea what I was getting into. And I just thought that was fascinating. Let's see. We're going long. This is the end. Meet the Parents.
This is the end.
That's fine. Kill Bill Volume 2 Phenomenon.
Kill Bill.
There has to be something funny. District 9 Ghost Rider.
Just because I have to pick District 9. fine, I'll take District 9.
The Sting, Indiana Jones, and the Temple of Doom.
Indiana Jones by far.
Okay, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade are The Sting.